In his famous novel, The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky includes a monk, Elder Zosima, who's talking about the riddle of how somebody can have ideals like this, but everyday practice totally different. He tells the story of a doctor. He says, there was a certain medical man, once told me long ago, Elder Zosima says, the man was already quite advanced in years and of unquestionable intelligence. He spoke just as frankly as you have done. The elder's talking to someone else. He said, I love mankind, but I marvel at myself. The more I love mankind in general, the less I love human beings, in particular, separately, that is, as individual persons. In my dreams, I would often arrive at fervent plans of devotion to mankind and might very possibly have gone to the cross for human beings had that been suddenly required of me, and yet I am unable to spend 2 days in the same room with someone else. And this I know from experience. No sooner is it that someone close to me comes close to me than this personality crushes my self-esteem, hampers my freedom. In the space of a day or a night, I am capable of coming to hate even the best of human beings. One, because he takes too long over dinner. Another, because he has a cold and is perpetually blowing his nose. I become the enemy of others very nearly as soon as they come into contact with me. To compensate for this, however, it has always happened that the more I have hated human beings in particular, the more ardent has become my love for mankind in general. That's damning, isn't it? And maybe just a little smidgen relatable. We're talking about randoms this morning. That is acquaintances, strangers, the people who just come in and out of our lives accidentally, the NPCs, you might say, in our lives. The villagers are in trouble. They need your help. How do you measure somebody's virtue? You could measure their public output, their declarations in the reels, and their public work. You could look at how they treat their friends. But you could also, how do you measure someone's virtue? You could also ask, well, a few weeks ago we were thinking about relationships with family. You could say, what are they like behind closed doors with those closest to them? Is it a different story? Are they one thing in public, another in private? Or today, another way you could do it is, how do you test someone's virtue? Ask how they treat the person behind the checkout. You know, ask how they treat the random in traffic, you know, who cuts in front of them or is in other ways an infuriating idiot. How do they treat the people who they won't have to see later on to get something out of, that they don't depend upon, who are not useful to them or a threat to them? How do they treat them? So how about you? Yeah, I mean, it might be what you say and do in public. I hope you do some good things and say some good things. How do you treat those nearest and dearest to you behind closed doors? How do you treat the NPCs in your life, the randoms, the non-player characters, the people who are you just encounter for a moment, who aren't a threat to you, aren't any use to you? How do you treat them? You never know, you see. So one of the things the Bible observes to us from time to time, Hebrews 13 has a famous verse about showing hospitality to strangers, because some people have entertained angels without realising it. You know, there's that. You never know who you might be dealing with. I mean, that's the 1-2 meet cute in a lot of rom-com sort of shows and movies, is when there's someone is rude in the first scene and then awkwardly in the second scene encounters that person in a different setting. Ah, awkward. You know, I didn't realise that kind of thing. You never know who you're dealing with. Some have entertained angels. In Luke's gospel, we're spending most of our time there. In chapter 16, there's a story Jesus tells about a really rich man who day after day would step over the poor man begging at his door. And then in the life hereafter, it's that poor man who actually is in glory and God's favour, and the rich man finds himself in Jesus' story kind of pleading with the poor man. You know, the poor man was rich where it really matters. Lazarus, the poor man. Similar story. Jesus tells about a religious person boasting before God, "Thank you, God, that I am so holy and pure, unlike this tax collector over there who dares not even come into your presence." And Jesus says, "Actually, you know what? It was the humble tax collector who asked for God's forgiveness who in the end went away justified before God, not the religious person." You never know by a judgment who who really matters, who's really right with God, who, as a Christian, you never know who's a brother or sister. Jesus says, "Who's my brother? Who's my mother? Who's my father? Anyone who hears God's will and obeys it is my mother, a brother, a father, a sister." You never know when the person you're shaking your fists at in traffic may actually be a long-lost spiritual brother or sister. Awkward. You never know when someone may be about the same thing you're about. Jesus says to his disciples, "Anyone who's not against us is for us." Don't shut someone down just because you don't know who they are already. You never know when you're dealing with those randoms, those strangers, those acquaintances, those people who bump in and out of your life like pinball. In fact, actually, the gospel itself is a bit of a you never know, isn't it? In John's gospel, it begins by saying, Jesus came to those who were his own and his own didn't recognize him. Even at the end of Luke's gospel, Jesus' resurrection appearances, at first he's often not distinguishable to people. People are walking along the road, chatting to Jesus. He asks them questions, they answer questions. And it's only at the end of the conversation they go, "Well, hang on a second, that's the Jesus of Nazareth we were just talking about. Oh my goodness." Yeah? You never know. Jesus mourns over, come and have a look at Luke 19, just a couple of verses there, which is the tragedy of this. He came to those who were his own and his own did not recognize him. Luke 19 verse 41, as he approached Jerusalem, Luke 19 41, and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you," Luke 19 42, "had known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes." Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, he mourned elsewhere. You don't realise. I'm a prophet in my hometown. You don't see who's right in front of you. You never know. Jesus doesn't just warn us of that chilling thought that I could blow it because I decide somebody's not worth my attention, not worth my respect, my kindness. Doesn't matter. Behave however I want. He acted that out. He walked the walk. But you see it throughout Jesus' life when he often gets interrupted. I'm alluding to a lot of things just to sort of kind of shortcut the short time we have together. But you could go back through Luke's gospel and note the many times, not just that Jesus deals with someone in a planned setting, but when someone kind of interrupts. Luke chapter 5, he's in a packed auditorium, a room, house. Some people are desperate to bring their paralyzed mate to him, so they dig a hole through this kind of ancient style of roofing to drop this guy right in front of Jesus. And Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, get this person out of here, security." He says, he sees their faith. Your sins are forgiven. He blesses the person. He defends the person. Jesus is at a meal. A dignified person, a woman, gets access to Jesus. Someone who the host and the other guests are scandal. What's she doing here? Ew. Why is Jesus, this woman comes and weeps before Jesus. And others are scandalized that this woman is in the room. Jesus instead says, "Actually, you know what? She's treated me better than you guys have. She's a better host in your own house than you are." She knows God's forgiveness that's available, that I've come to bring as the Saviour. And so she loves on a whole other level. Doesn't say get her out of here. Another woman interrupts Jesus as he's on the way somewhere to bring a healing, a planned visit, a planned healing. Reaches out, I could touch the corner of the hem of his robe. She thinks to herself, and again, Jesus stops. "Your faith has healed you." Time and again, as Jesus is interrupted by the 10 lepers, "Have mercy on us, Jesus, son of David." Or blind Bartimaeus, "Have mercy on us, me, Jesus, son of," in Luke 17, Luke 18. Or the people in Luke 18 bring in little kids to Jesus. Others say, "Oh, no, don't bother the teacher. with little dribbly, snotty kids. No, 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 let the kids come. The kingdom of heaven is for such as these. Jesus didn't just talk the talk. He walked the walk. He himself loved those, even those who interrupted, who imposed. Yeah. But let's zero in on some of Jesus' teaching and think what that means for us in practice. So that'd be the bulk of our time together. We're going to look through Luke's gospel still at four cases of Jesus' teaching that's relevant to this, how we relate to the humans in particular, who are the randoms of no one in particular, you know, the other person who joins your group work project at uni that you don't know, you know, the person who, when you go to hang out with your friend, is also there, and it kind of makes it not as fun. The person in traffic, the person who just serves you at the cafe or the restaurant. Hey, actually, you know, going back to speaking about sorry, I don't know if I should say this in the recording. I'll pause the recording. Just for you. Now, the people on the internet have no idea what I just said. You'll never know. It should have come in person. So let's think about that in practice. How do we respond to the artist, the checkout chick, the taxi driver, the neighbour, and so on and so on and so on? All right. First of all, Luke chapter 6. We'll come back to this teaching in our last session because it's related to loving enemies. But Luke chapter 6, Jesus talks about loving our enemies and those who inconvenience us as well. Luke chapter 6, verse 27, I say to you who are listening, Luke 6, 27, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for the ones who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them, give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others what you'd have them do to you. Note, by the way, here, Jesus isn't talking about refusing to have self-defense for actual violence and oppression. Here we're dealing with these kind of insulting inconveniences primarily is what he's describing there. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? That's if you love those who love you, quid pro quo, tit for tat, you give, I give, scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. If you just do that, well, that's not that impressive. That's just transactional altruism. Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect a repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great and you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. We'll come back to that, as I said, in October. But it's Jesus is saying, yeah, love all people. All individual humans in particular, even the ones who put you out, demand things of you, are unfair, are a nuisance, are unreliable, love people, be merciful. Jesus was being whacked up on the cross and said, Father, forgive them in Luke 23. They don't know what they do. Father, forgive them. Incredible. I mean, there's another you never know, right beside him, a thief, deserving to come under the penalty of the law, proves himself to be one of Jesus' brothers, doesn't he? Remember me, Jesus, when you come into your glory. Jesus says, I'll be with you today in paradise. Yeah. In Luke 23. So love even your enemies, even those who put you out. How do you go at that? I mean, again, you never know, I was saying earlier. On another level, there's something you do know. You do know every single human being you see, everyone who puts you out, every moron in the social media thread who's wrong about the thing, every person in a pornographic image, every person who is the unfair other team who takes the fall and draws the penalty that wins the match, everyone, every single person you do know is created in God's image and is loved by God. Yeah? He is the Father who is merciful and shows love, and even to the ungrateful and the wicked, verse 33. So you do know, actually, anyone you encounter is a fellow image bearer. Treat them as such. Don't use them. Don't abuse them. Related to that, Jesus immediately goes on to talk about judging, and this certainly helps us in the way we treat others when we flare up some kind of you know, anger or resentment or jealousy. Yeah, this avoidance of judgment. Have a look at the next little bit there, Luke 6, verse 37. Don't judge, or you'll be judged. Don't condemn, or you'll be condemned. Forgive, and you'll be forgiven. Again, like the inconvenience thing, it's not that Jesus is saying there's never a time for self-defense, but he's rather saying there are so many times for not standing on your rights. In the same way, it's not that there's never a place for discernment, that you never are discerning in any sense, judging in any sense, but this judge over judgment, over condemnatory spirit is what he's going at. Given will be given to you, verse 38. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be poured into your lap. For the measure you used, it will be measured to you. Treat others the way you want to be treated again, right? That golden rule. He told them this parable. We'll skip the parable and go just to that next little bit. Verse 41, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, brother, just let me take that speck out of your eye, when you fail to see the plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. Take the plank out of your eye. Then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. If you realize your own faults and flaws, remember that you need God's mercy, that every time you point a finger, three are pointing right back at you. If you assume you don't know the full story as your starting point, that person seemed awful, but maybe I don't know the full story. You know, in addition to feeling, helping a kid be righteously angry at a bully, you need to help a kid also have a fair bit of pity for a bully, because it's a pretty pitiful thing to be a bully. And often the reasons people become bullies are for pitiful, sad, awful reasons. If I assume incompetence first rather than malice first. Have you heard that expression? Assume incompetence, not malice. Most of the time, the person messed you around, mucked you over, just because they're bad at their job, because most of us are, most of the time. Most of us kind of, you know, aren't great at what we do and do things, and other people suffer as a result. So just assume the person was just sloppy rather than out to get you. You know? Now, sometimes they are out to get you, sure, you know, but as a starting point, don't judge. As a starting point, don't condemn. As a starting point, don't assume malice. Don't assume that you know the whole story. That's that kind of starting point thing. Yeah. How do you go with that? Easier said than done, isn't it? But yeah, it's a good one to remember. The Good Samaritan is what we looked at next, wasn't it? Luke chapter 10, you flip back there to remind yourself of it if you like. But the context is important. Notice the context is somebody who wants to see whether they're satisfying God's requirements, you know, to pick a risky sort of modern example that's loaded, I know, and it's happening in real time. But it's a bit like the Jew today saying, who is my neighbour? Yeah, who is my neighbour? Who's the one I need to love? And that call to love has to include those over the border, doesn't it? In Gaza. However that looks, that's a complicated question. But that's the kind of degree of intensity of the question here. It's like, don't just love those within your circle of trust and love and belonging and ethnicity and religion, but those who maybe your enemies are the other, you know, that actually true religion includes that love. And so Jesus tells a story, and a key part of the story is not just the example of love, but the fact that the person who is the hero in the story is not the Levite, is not the priest. Who is the person who doesn't pass by? It's not the priest. It's not the Levite, but verse 33, it's the Samaritan. It's the not one of us, the over the border, the not the same ethnicity and religion and group. That's the hero of the story. And Jesus then asks the expert in religious law, so who was the neighbour? Who did the act of neighbouring, verse 36? And the person can't even bring themselves to say the words Samaritan. They beat around the bush, the one who had mercy on him. Go and be a neighbour. Go go and be a neighbour to whoever crosses your path, whatever non-player character, NPC, whatever acquaintance, whatever service staff, whatever strangers, acquaintances, enemies, be a neighbour. That's the first bite in this story. Notice that in this case, we're dealing with someone who... Now, the nature of love within this story, it's someone who just encounters another. So this isn't about loving your mates, loving your church, loving your family. This is about, I am going along a road and encounter someone in need. I'm on my way to Jericho, and on the way to Jericho, I encounter someone in trouble. That's interesting for two reasons. One, it reminds us that there are duties that we may find ourselves or opportunities for love that aren't planned. So that's a good reminder that some of the way we need to live our religious life, our ethical life, some of the ways we need to judge ourselves is not just by the planned love that we already pledged to do, but the inconvenient love that we find ourselves stumbling upon. That's important for that reason. It's also helpful in another way a bit because I think sometimes we can get stuck thinking a bit like in the Dostoevsky quote from the beginning that we need to love every single human being across the entire planet with equal kind of universal love, which of course is you can't do that. You're just one human being, right? There is a sense in which the way in which we live out this duty to love anybody is within our embodied existence, right? Like you love your family, your friends, your church, and so on. And you love the strangers that you just, as you're going along the road, come into contact with. You know what I mean? And so there's that sense in which there is an... I don't have to somehow find out a way to care about every single cause on the planet and find something in me to emotionally engage with the same degree of grief and concern with every single issue. There is a degree to which I care about those close to me, but also care about those that become close to me, that I just bump into, as I've been saying during the sermon. You know, that I go, well, then that's part of how I encounter this need and this challenge. Now, that's a little strange in a globalised world. I realise that. And so in some ways you could say in a globalised world, there's also my sense of calling that bumps into things, you could say. So you might bump into starting to really care about Israel and Gaza or Russia and Ukraine or certain countries that are struggling below the poverty line with curable illnesses, or, you know, you might find yourself caring especially about ecological impacts. And so you walk along the road of your emotional vocation and start to care about a cause, you know. But that's the second thing. It's that there is a degree to which we travel through life and have to then work this out in our particular life. Yeah. Notice, lastly, the range of care that this Samaritan shows. It's a good little kind of stepping through the kinds of care you can show. Samaritan sees him, has pity on him, so there's emotional engagement. There's observation. There's emotional engagement. Verse 34, he then provides initial first aid. Then he brings the person to some place of sustained care, and then returns and provides funding to ensure that care is sustained. Now, we may not always do all of those steps, but it does show a picture of the range of ways. Sometimes we may just engage by noticing and caring, praying, rather than being oblivious. Sometimes we provide that primary response. Sometimes we engage in ongoing, sustained care in one way or another. How are you going with that? How are you going with showing that kind of concern for others that you happen upon? Are you the person who just worries and goes, oh dear, it doesn't do much ever? Do you ever follow up? Maybe you know, if you've been through grief yourself, one of the things that's really powerful is the person who diarises your grief and comes back to it later. There's a Christian art festival happening in the Huon called the Pilgrim Artist Festival, and one of the non-fiction pieces in that is about written by a woman who suffered a miscarriage, I think, and it's about her saying to all her family, you know, can you please mark this date, because it's a real point of grief for me, having, you know, lost this child I never got to have. And the shock this woman experienced a year later when only one person remembered. You know, she explicitly said, hey, this is a point of grief, can you remember me on this day? One person did. So, you know, there's that way of that ongoing care of even just remembering other people's pain. Because many of us can be good in a crisis, but can we be good in that in the more long-term way? There's a thought. And then last of all, I'll just go on to the last of all. Jesus gives some banquet teaching in Luke 14, verses 12 to 14, first of all. Luke 14, verses 12 to 14. Jesus is at a banquet and then gives this series of different kind of parables, teachings, metaphors, challenges to the people in attendance there. And we're just going to look at two of those in Luke 14. First, verses 12 to 14. Luke 14, verses 12 to 14. Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, don't invite your friends, your brothers and sisters, your relatives, your rich neighbours. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Now, Jesus is talking again in a culture where there are a certain kind of public reciprocal acts of hospitality. And in that kind of setting in particular, they're saying when it comes to those contexts, don't merely, you know, like Jesus often speaks in this strong, over-the-top way, don't invite any of the people you're related to make the point. But he's saying don't just operate your entire life of hospitality in just this kind of reciprocal, communitarian, beneficial altruism. Actually open the doors and include others who won't pay you back. Don't rule the friends out of your life when they stop being useful to you in terms of popularity or entertainment or your same level of intelligence or accomplishment or income or good looks or whatever. Include the friend who maybe in some worldly ways you've sort of left behind as you've grown up, but they're still a friend. Include them. In church context, this can often be an issue. And actually in young adult context, most of you here, that can be an issue. That transition, I mean, not good in youth group either, but as you transition into young adulthood, and if you still operate in youth group mindset is, I'm mainly going for the friends, and some mainly going for the friends of the opposite sex, and then the games and the food, and Bible's good too. You know, something like that, you know, to varying degrees. Some it's like the Bible, I'll put up with it for the sake of the other things. Others it's like, yeah, the Bible's good too, but you know, the friends and the pizza's pretty awesome. Talent night's the highlight sort of thing. If you bring that into your adult Christianity, then you're still thinking, what I want to get out of church, what I want to get out of uni fellowship, what I want to get out of young adult events is the people I like, want to like me, and whatever the equivalent is of the pizza. Maybe the food's slightly nicer now, but still, you know, it's the nice curry made from scratch. That's what I'm interested in. And I'm interested in whatever the equivalent of the games is at that next stage up of life. That, in other words, needs loving those who love me. My needs met. Now, you know, I know there's nothing wrong with friends, finding romantic partners, nothing wrong. I love pizza. You know, I used to work in a pizza shop when I was your age, and people would say, oh, you're going to get sick of pizza, aren't you, working in a pizza shop? Not true. Impossible to get sick of pizza. I mean, I know what the words in the sentence means, get sick of pizza. I don't know what the sentence really means. So those things are all good things, just as having a banquet with your family and your rich neighbours can be a good thing. You know, Jesus isn't... He's talking in blunt ways, but he's not absolute. However, there is something sick in a young adult group or a youth group that actually functionally excludes the person who's whatever it is, uncool, awkward, poor, smelly, name whatever the thing is, right? And there's something Jesus cool about Christian fellowship that actually includes the people, the strange, the not desirable. It should feel different, shouldn't it? Our Christian fellowship should look and feel and smell and vibe different. Yeah? That there's a kind of cool that's the really cool cool that comes with accepting those of all sorts. Huge challenge of Jesus. And then verses 21 to 23 in this banquet teaching, we finish with this. Because that same attitude, that same mindset is how God brings salvation to the world. And within the context of this parable, about God's heavenly banquet. That's the context. Here's God's mindset as the master in his great banquet. He says, Luke 14, verse 21, see the quotation halfway through? Go out into the streets and the alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Sir, what you've ordered has been done. There's still room. Verse 23, then the master said, go out to the roads, the country lanes, and compel them to come in so my house will be full. That's God's attitude with his great, his heavenly eternal banquet. Heaven is described not just as kind of clouds and spirits and harps and hymns, as a banquet, a feast, a celebration. And God's invitation is, let's go find people. Let's go out, let's go around the back, into the corner. Let's go beyond. You know, I can't help but think like a world mission at that point. Go out in the country lanes, go wherever you can to find people, to invite people to come and celebrate and enjoy, feast with God. That's an exciting picture, isn't it? That's the invitation of the Christian gospel. Come to God's great feast. You're welcome, even if you're his enemy. He loves his enemies. Has mercy on those who've walked away from him. He brings forgiveness and healing and release from those who are prisoners to guilt, and shame, death, sin, and this dying world. Awesome thought. And so when we are involved in inviting somebody to church or uni fellowship or to read the Bible with us, that invitation is ultimately the beginning of an invitation to that heavenly banquet. Let's pray.